Hey, good morning. Welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm going to be with you for the next hour, and I hope we have an interesting show lined up for you. I think we do. Lauren Larson is our producer, and we've got two guests today. We're going to be, as usual, following the money, looking at legislation and what's likely to happen, what's coming down the road for federal workers and retirees and postal employees, for that matter. My first guest is Andy Medici. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times. Andy, are you with us?
Always good to be here, Mike.
Listen, it's good to have you. And because we are Washington-based card-carrying journalists and indeed pundits, self-appointed maybe, but we are. It's obligatory that we talk about the State of the Union address. And Julia Ziegler from our staff was there last night reporting on it, and she said it's interesting how small the House chamber seems when you get all of those 435 members, plus friends, plus 100 members of the Senate and their staff, and how interesting it was. The interesting thing for me about every State of the Union, and it doesn't matter who's president or which party controls which body, but the most interesting thing for me is who's not there.
Yes, you know, this is one of those situations where, you know, if you show up and have everyone important, you know, there's only a couple exceptions to that. One is, you know, a member of the cabinet that has to stay behind in case something happens. And the others are people who would rather choose not to be there if they, you know, even though they could.
Yes, that's right. Well, I always think, and it's in some years, without naming any presidents, but there are some years when I saw who was not there, who was next in line to be president in case of a sort of a massive terrorist attack. It was frightening. I prayed for everybody's safety.
Well, you know, there's been a couple years where Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, you know, would have been that next in line. So, you know, someone has to stay behind, I suppose.
Yeah, and it varies too. Sometimes they'll just stay at their home with added protection, and sometimes they'll hustle them up to a hideout in West Virginia or on the Eastern Shore, just to be on the safe side.
Yeah, I think this time around it was the interior. Was it the Interior Secretary who stayed behind?
You know, I didn't catch it after all that we were talking about it. But one person on the staff here mentioned that one year they had designated a particular cabinet officer to go, and it turns out she was not born in the U.S.
So she would not
have been constitutionally eligible for that. So you know, a lot of things to think about there.
No, you're definitely right. You know, the State of the Union is one of those speeches that everyone looks forward to every year, and then no matter what is announced in the speech, you know, there are people who say, oh, it could have been a better speech, and people who say it was a great speech. I think this year, you know, the president talked a little bit about federal issues, but, you know, it wasn't like last year or the year before where there were some substantial things that feds could really sink their teeth into.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, to see everybody has to put an interpretation on it. And you look at the Post this morning in the New York Times, and I'm checking other papers, and although there's some herd-like thing going on, what different people saw in that is absolutely amazing. It tells you more, I think, about them than it does the person who's delivering the State of the Union.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, it is a litmus test. You know, you read what you want to. You know, if you like Obama, then some of these proposals are great, and if you don't, some of them are really bad. And you know, at the end of the day, there's 12 hours of pregame, 12 hours of postgame. But then whatever actually happens is what's important, right?
Yeah, it's so interesting. One of the papers characterized the president as defiant. And I don't know that I saw that, but maybe so.
Well, you know, you gotta fill inches somewhere, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. We all have to have an opinion. Hey, you have an interesting story going this week in Federal Times. Headline is Brace Yourself, Congress Preps Civil Service Reform. But I guess you talked with the new chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee.
Yes, I talked to the House Oversight and Reform Committee, Jason Chaffetz, and also the subcommittee chair that oversees federal workforce issues. And you know, this isn't, I think, going to be some sort of major overhaul. But I think what feds are going to see is they're going to see at least legislation introduced and ushered through the House that would sort of take aim at some of those benefits and pay and accountability issues that, you know, we talk about so often.
Right. Well, they seem to be there was a lot of emphasis on being able to fire federal workers, incompetent or illegal, immoral or fattening federal workers, and also to go with the benefits package.
Yeah, you know, as I was listening to the radio show before I came on, you know, I heard you, you know, talking about how federal benefits tend to be more generous. The pay is always an issue, but on the benefits side, feds have a pretty good package. And I think for a lot of lawmakers, it's just a bit too tempting a target, especially when you're looking at areas to cut. And while it doesn't happen often, it has happened, with the increase in pension contributions that was passed a couple of years ago. That had a significant impact on incoming feds. So this is one of those situations where now that there's a Republican-led House and a Republican-led Senate, the chances of legislation at least getting through both chambers has gone up a bit. President Obama has issued veto threats, but you never know what might be negotiated away if you need to pass a budget or a continuing resolution.
Well, that's right, and it's obligatory in Washington that we all denounce gridlock. It is as a bad thing, but in fact, if you're a potential target group, as federal workers and to some extent retirees always are, when you have gridlock, the result is nothing happens. Nothing good happens, but also maybe even more importantly, nothing bad happens.
And I think that's a pretty easy decision to make when you consider what are the odds that Congress would pass something about federal civil servants that would be beneficial or that would increase, the benefits that they already have. I think a lot of people realize that that's pretty much at zero.
2009, many people believe that was the high water mark for federal workers. That was the year a number of things that had been on the back burner, had been pending for years, were passed into law. And then everybody said, whether whistling happy days are here again. And then the next year, and the next year, and the next year, you have pay freeze. And then you have 2 years of 1% pay raises. I guess one of the litmus tests coming up is these 31 members of Congress, all Democrats, who have introduced a bill that would give federal workers a 3.8% raise in January of 2016. I'm sure not many people are spending that money yet or budgeting for it. But is it interesting and is it significant that all 31 members are Democrats? Does that mean there were no Republicans in the Congress that like Democrats or that like federal workers, or does it mean that they weren't invited to be co-sponsors?
Well, if some of this legislation, there have been bills that have been introduced in the past, 10 or 15 years that involved federal pay raises, and they had a few Republicans on it. I don't think it's ever been 50-50, but I think, a lot of federal employees could sort of name off, a couple of Republicans in the past who have been stronger proponents of federal employees. And I think what you've seen more recently is that it really has solidified as a party issue, as a partisan issue. And that's probably not a good thing for federal employees. I think if a Republican wanted to co-sponsor this bill, from what I've heard, I think Democrats would have welcomed it. In order for them to pass anything, they're gonna have to have a lot of Republican support.
Well, unless the conspiracy theory thing here, unless the Democrats set this up knowing it's a straw man, it's 3.8%, it's not going to happen, but they can go to the federal unions and their federal workers in their districts and say, "Look, I tried, but those rascally Republicans control both the House and the Senate."
I mean, I think that's a fair criticism. Last year, I asked some of the lawmakers, why even introduce the bill at all if there's no chance of it passing. And the response I did get was that they want to move the discussion in a different direction, because when you look at the debates right now, a lot of it centers around should federal employees get no raise or should they get 1%, right? And that's the discussion. So if you get 1%, that's the best possible outcome. But if you start talking up 3% or 4%, maybe you end up getting 2%. It's all about shifting the discussion and sort of managing expectations. And I think a lot of people want to stop talking about 0% and start talking about at least some sort of positive number that might be above one.
Well, I knew people who worked for Congressman Frank Wolf, who retired this year. He's been replaced over in Fairfax County, the Reston area. And he never said anything about it, but they frequently complained that they were excluded from deals, and that particularly some of the federal unions would give him support, but they wouldn't let him announce that they had given him support.
Well, and that's a tricky issue. When it comes to politics, right? Politics ain't beanbag, and federal unions, a lot of them are also attached to larger unions that have larger interests. But also, while Frank Wolf is one of the Republicans that we can both point to as someone who, you've seen them on bills about, reasonable reforms and legislation involving the federal workforce. But he is also a member of a party that will introduce bills that are against that. So, it was always a tough situation. I think a lot of people won't realize that they might miss Frank Wolf when he's gone, right?
Yeah.
But also, I think what you're seeing is that the area where there used to be moderate Republicans who support the federal workforce, Northern Virginia is getting more and more Democratic every year, and the room for that is quickly fading. And I think you're going to get a lot more of the party line issues when it comes to federal employees.
And you need to take a short break here, but we'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
At American University, we believe that a college education is measured by more than a sheet of paper you hang on your wall and an office with a corner view. Here we stand up for causes as naturally as we sit down for classes. For us, DC is more than our address. It's our playground, our classroom, and our laboratory. Honors and degrees don't make us who we are. Meaningful change does. We're passionate. We're engaged. We're wonks. We are American University.
Night vision, enabled by Ingenuity. Excellus improves situational awareness by delivering the world's most advanced night vision goggles. Excellus Night Vision also protects federal and local first responders. From image intensification to multi-sensor fusion, Excellus has you covered. Enhance your mission with the power of Ingenuity. Visit exelisinc.com/federal. That's exelisinc.com/federal. Excellus, the power of Ingenuity.
At Vencor, our team is 4,800 strong and ready to tackle any challenge. Our name might be new, but our company has over 40 years of proven performance in systems engineering, smart analytics, cybersecurity, and applied research. Whether we're supporting space launches like NASA's recent Orion exploration flight test, securing critical infrastructure, or analyzing data to save lives, Vencor delivers mission-critical solutions no matter how complex the challenge. Find out more at Vencor.com.
And now it's time for another FedGuard Factor, career essentials for federal employees.
Did you know that you can protect your paycheck for less than $1 a day? That's right. With the protection you get with FedGuard's Professional Federal Employee Liability Insurance, you can have a lawyer protect your paycheck for less than $1 a day. Now is the perfect time to assess your needs and purchase this comprehensive, affordable coverage for the peace of mind you deserve.
Learn more at FedGuard.com. That's FedGuard.com.
Okay, so 5 tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
$10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's 12 bucks, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Please join the Armed Forces Communications and Electronics Association Washington, D.C. chapter on February 6, 2015 in Arlington, Virginia to hear from 5 women who have distinguished themselves with their professional capabilities and expertise. Across reconnaissance, cyber, signals intelligence, and both tactical and strategic analysis, these leaders are shaping future budgets and priorities as they respond to the dynamic requirements of our world today. To reserve your seat and for more information, visit dcfciachapters.org.
Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Andy Medici, senior writer with the Federal Times, and His story today is, brace yourselves, Congress preps for civil service reform. Andy, I think a lot of people are worried about, more worried about what the Congress is likely to do to the retirement system than any other single factor. I think that's true.
I think for a lot of people that's the case, because for current retirees, obviously you're worried about current benefits. But for a lot of federal employees, they have traded higher salaries in the private sector for, better benefits and a better retirement package. And a lot of them would be worried about Congress cutting into that.
Well, in the past, when Congress has made changes, and they haven't made very many at all, but when they have made changes that are sort of negative to the federal package, they did it prospectively so that people hired in 2013 paid slightly more for their will pay more for their retirement than people hired before that date, and then people hired in 2014 will pay slightly more than people hired in 2013. I believe that's the way it works. Now, that's all prospective. So if you've been in the government 5, 10, 15 years, it doesn't worry you. You may not even be aware of it, but it's happened. But in order to make the savings in the Congressional Budget Office and Congressional Research Service have looked at this, you could make an immediate huge savings if you would apply that to everybody working right now.
That's correct. You know, I think a lot of people forget the amount of money that goes into pensions, the amount of money that agencies spend, and fairly too for benefits that were promised to federal employees. But for lawmakers or for budget analysts who are poring over those documents and all they see are a bunch of zeros and commas, you know, it's a tempting target. And I think even if you make changes prospective, I think a lot of federal employees know that it's a tough situation to sort of say I've got mine and incoming feds shouldn't. And it could just be the tip of the spear. You know, if you don't take time to protect incoming federal employee benefits, are you degrading the workforce? You know, are you preventing people in future generations from having the benefits that you've enjoyed? And I think for a lot of people that rings true as well.
Well, and you know, you look at what's happened in the state and local government level, cities going bankrupt, literally abolishing pension plans, and even abolishing the benefits that were promised to people by law. This has happened. And if you have the private sector moving away from a defined benefit plan, such as the government has now, isn't it possible that the government's going to follow suit sooner rather than later?
Well, that's a thorny issue. I was listening to the Postmaster General's farewell speech he gave at the press club. And, you know, I've seen it in Federal News Radio as well, that he said, you know, there should be some thought given to a defined contribution instead of a defined benefit plan. And then he encouraged lawmakers to, you know, perhaps start with the Postal Service, where you might have more leeway to move to that system, and, you know, use it as a test bed for across the government. And I think that worries people. You mentioned it yourself, but I think the last numbers I saw were 4 or 5%. Only about 4 or 5% of the private sector workforce has access to a defined benefit plan, while federal employees, of course, they get that. And although I just want to, you know, I always want to add that the reason we have FERS and CSRS is because people saw a shortfall with CSRS and they created FERS, which a lot of state and local governments didn't really either see it coming or didn't want to see it coming. But on the federal side, they created that second retirement system specifically to reduce future liability. So, pension reform has already come, and it's already happened, and it's already passed. It just happened a while ago, and for a lot of people, tend to forget that.
Well, Ted Stevens, the late senator from Alaska, was, the godfather of FERS, and some people thought that was a punitive thing, but what they were saying is we can't sustain the civil service retirement system as it is. The employees at that point kicked in 7%, but the total cost to the government, to the taxpayers, was something like 28%. So most CSRS retirees got back all of their contributions in the first 18 months of retirement. So it really wasn't a pay-as-you-go system. So in order to save the village, they had to burn down part of it, and that's where you switch from CSRS to FERS. But now you've got a new group of people in there, and they're looking at the trend in the private sector, and many companies that at one time offered very good retirement packages, cradle to grave and that sort of thing, have now dropped them, and they're letting the employees get by on Social Security and any money they put in, and maybe the company will kick in some contributions, but the money that they will put into a 401k plan. That seems to be the wave of the future everywhere else.
Yeah, I think you get a lot of that, you know, saying that success is privatized but failure is socialized, in the sense that a lot of companies, they are moving away from offering sort of any sort of retirement plan, because why should they? You know, they can just dump people into Social Security and Medicare and let them fend for themselves. And I think for federal employees, you know, that is a legitimate fear. You know, we talked about, you know, FERS reform, and it wasn't as bad as it could have been. But, you know, when you hear lawmakers talk about other programs, far more popular programs among the general public, Social Security and Medicare, And they say things like, we have to reduce benefits in the future to make the system work. You know, as a federal employee, you know, that would create a lot of worry that, you know, you're in a program that has a lot of people in it, but the general public isn't going to rally to your defense probably if they were to reduce benefits.
Well, you know, you and I have talked about this in the past over lunch and whatnot, about sort of our duty, if you will, of balancing the news. You want to let people know what's out there and some of the potentially bad stuff that lurks. But on the other hand, you don't want to scare people. And we've been doing the same old thing for years and years and years now. These things are proposed and then they go away. And I wonder if you recall years back now when John Berry was the new director of the Office of Personnel Management. He's since gone on to be ambassador to Australia. But when he was director at OPM, President Obama took him to at least two cabinet meetings, which was unprecedented for an OPM director. And he said, this is my personnel guy. I want to make government cool again. If he asks you for something, turning to the cabinet secretaries, help him out. And that was a big boost for Berry. And then Berry, in turn, came out with a very dramatic civil service reform plan. I don't know if you recall it, but among other things, they would sort of abolish grades, and there'd be three levels of people. I think journeyman was one, and expert was another, and beginner. And it was revolutionary, but coming from John Berry and with his standing in the administration, people took notice, and it just faded away.
I think it is hard to push civil service reform on the administration side. You know, I think a lot of the times we've seen reform, it's come from members of Congress. You know, and you talked about Ted Stevens, but, you know, usually it comes as part of a compromise or sort of a larger movement. And the administration has pushed some ideas in the past with John Berry and you know, the Clinton administration pushed some. And you know, even the Bush administration, you know, to a large extent, they sort of transformed a lot of government, you know, with DHS and TSA and their sort of special hiring and firing authorities. And I think what you end up getting is usually the change comes from Congress, suggested by the administration. But when it comes to sort of large-scale civil service reform, I'm not sure I expect it to come from the administration, at least as an entirely complete idea. I'd more than likely expect it to come from Congress.
The Carter administration managed to do it, but that may, you're right, that may well be the last thing like that in our lifetime.
Well, and it's one of those situations where, you know, in each time it's been done, you know, whether we're talking about that DOD one with, you know, the national security sort of pay bans or whether it was John Berry's idea. But one of the issues with civil service reform is that you would have to give it a lot of time to see if it was working. The first few years would essentially be a mess, right? And I think people recognize that. It would be hard to organize. It would be hard to transfer who would go where, who would get what. Some people would have to make less. Some might make more. But it would take years, and it's hard to introduce that, knowing that, for example, if you're the administration, it would probably you'd all be gone by the time it, you know, it even started getting rolling. And so we've seen people pull back on those sorts of reforms and, you know, just pull back on them entirely because of the amount of time it would take.
You mentioned earlier the Postmaster General and his sort of farewell speech at the press club, and he's definitely did not go quietly. He's the one that proposed setting up a postal-only health insurance program, and then he was talking about a postal-only retirement plan, and he was, as you said, he was urging maybe Congress to test it out in the Postal Service and then possibly apply it to the rest of the government. And that would be a sea change, because in the past, most of the, quote, innovative things have come out of the Defense Department. It's the biggest. It's used to experimentation. It's used to getting around. But buyouts started with the Defense Department. The National Security Personnel System, the merit pay was at the Defense Department. And it would be interesting if, for tactical reasons or for whatever, they switched to the, I guess it's the second largest department in government, that would be the U.S. Postal Service, and if they started making it the laboratory.
I think actually that would be a smarter choice. The Postal Service, you know, under the Postal Service Enhancement Act of 2006, it got a lot of latitude in what it does and why. It still has some, you know, conditions placed upon it. But the Defense Department, despite its ability to sort of, you know, experiment, it's still a department. The Postal Service is something else. It used to be the Postal Department. It's now the Postal Service with some of those authorities. But certain executive orders don't really apply to it. Certain federal guidelines don't really apply to it. It's kind of a special entity and unique unto itself. And in that agency, you know, in the Postal Service, you have management that wants change as opposed to maybe managers that really wouldn't in other agencies. So you would have that on board. And I think for a lot of people, you know, it might be tempting to see, well, if the Postal Service wants it, at least maybe not the rank and file, but the managers and the people leading it, maybe it would be easier to implement and maybe it would be easier to keep that going long enough to see if it works.
Excellent. We'll pursue this at a later date. Andy Medici, thank you very much for being with us. Talk to you later. And we're going to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Be right back.
Wizards fans, catch all the action as your Wizards take on a Western Conference power. Hometown star Kevin Durant leads his Oklahoma City Thunder into the Verizon Center on January 21st at 8 p.m.
Butler lob for Nene. Down toward the baseline left in the left corner. Nene head down, drives, one of the baskets. Stoop right there! Oh, boy. Nene throws it down with a meat hook.
Individual tickets still remain, so call 1-800-745-3000 or visit WashingtonWizards.com today.
Open standards, fabric, software-defined networking, and pay-as-you-go flexibility are essential building blocks for the new IP, the modern approach to data center networking. But it's not just about technology. Forward-thinking federal agencies can achieve huge cost savings and innovation when they align IT acquisition to their core mission requirements rather than to a specific vendor or brand. For more insights about federal IT procurement, download Federal Manager survey results at federalnewsradio.com. Search procurement. Brocade, helping government IT transition to the new IP.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Tracy McRae. When it comes to your health, who wouldn't want an extra set of eyes watching over things, especially when you're very ill?
We see it as an added layer of safety, an added layer of monitoring, and intervention quickly when needed.
Dr. Sean Caples is talking about an enhanced critical care program where physicians and nurses remotely monitor ICU patients in six outlying hospitals in the Mayo Clinic Health System. Sophisticated software records trends and changes in a patient's condition and alerts on-site staff to changes.
There's a lot of published literature that shows programs like the enhanced critical care system will reduce the amount of time a patient stays in the ICU, in the hospital overall, and will even reduce the rates of mortality associated with severe illness.
Taking advantage of technology to deliver the best care possible. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Tracy McRae.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
This hour of news is brought to you by Boeing. The EA-18 Growler is the only electronic attack aircraft in production, and we need to keep it in production to ensure mission success. Take action. Go to supportgrowler.com.
Acquisition and Industry Thursday on Federal News Radio. At 3, listen for The Coalition for Government Procurement's Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron. Federal contracting experts from both inside and outside of government give their views on the intersection of procurement policy and process and hear from companies themselves on policy, regulations, and trends on Industry Chatter with Francis Rose, Thursdays at 4. Acquisition and Industry Thursday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. My next guest is Jessica Clement. She is legislative director and more for the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Jesse, are you with us?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you. I know you have a busy day, so we'll get right down to it. The obligatory question the day after State of the Union, was there anything in it aimed at feds?
There was not. I had my phone and my computer ready to tweet along with everybody else if the president said anything. He did mention the memorandum He sent out to agency heads last week advancing sick leave for federal employees very, very briefly towards the first half of the speech. But other than that, very little mention of any federal employee or retiree issues.
Well, now, you've been watching this for a long time. I know you worked on Capitol Hill, so you've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. You were with the Federal Managers Association, so you got the federal manager's perspective and outlook, and now you're with NARF. Now, NARF is everybody is welcome, correct?
Yes, we will take all, including, you know, survivors of federal employees who may not have worked for the federal government. You know, a lot of those individuals' dependents call us up asking questions about, you know, their federal benefits once their loved one has passed away. So NARF is here advocating for the active federal employees, current federal employees, the retired ones, and their spouses and survivors.
Yeah, and you actually had a NARF president who was the survivor of a federal worker but had herself never worked for the government.
We did. It was before my time here at NARF. It was the president before this one, Margaret Baptiste. She's very well known in the federal community. Our current secretary treasurer is also the spouse of a retired federal employee.
Right. And at one point, it was the National Association of Retirees, and then somebody said, no, that doesn't make sense. What we're doing is our mission in life is to protect the retirement system. You know,
right.
And these active duty people should be at least as interested in that as retirees.
If not more so, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I think there was a void out there for, you know, the current federal employees who, you know, weren't union employees but not quite management either. You know, they may have wanted an association to join as well. So NARF is here. About 10% of our members are current federal employees. I know there's a lot of confusion out there. I hear people say all the time, oh, I'll just join NARF when I retire,
yeah.
No, please join now.
Yeah, okay. I was talking earlier with Andy Medici about so many of these, quote, threats that are facing federal workers and retirees have been around forever, and there's no mincing it. None of them have happened save the slight changes that were prospective for people under the FERS retirement system. They're going to have to pay more for their benefits, but that doesn't affect people who were in the job and in place. But it seems to me there's a new dynamic here. And looking at the new lineup in Congress, the fact that so many state and local governments have gone broke, have had to retrench, have had to modify their retirement plans and do that. And you think that could have a spillover effect in the federal government?
I think what we're looking at in terms of the budget process for 2015 will absolutely have an impact on federal pay and benefits, particularly for the current federal employees. Like you mentioned, those hired before 2013 have had no changes to their retirement contributions. I think what we're looking at for the budget process as we get into the spring and early summer, with the possibility of budget reconciliation, which is signed into law by the president, it's actually how the Affordable Care Act passed several years ago, and only requires a majority in the Senate, not the 60 votes. If we get to a point where budget reconciliation is looking likely, that is where feds will take the biggest hit in 2015, and we're already working to make sure that that doesn't happen. If they move towards budget reconciliation to leave federal employees alone, but it could be, it's looking like an uphill battle for us this year.
And not from a fairness standpoint, but from a fiscal and a realistic standpoint, the way to save money, if you're going to go after a retirement system, the way to save money for the people who are paying for it is to cut current benefits and to cut the benefits of employees that are already in the system. They're either vested or they're retired. And that's where you get your big savings. When you do it prospectively, as they have done, and hit only people hired after 2013 and people hired after 2014, you have some savings, but they're 10 years, 20 years down the road.
Right. But I mean, even still, when they hit the, you know, Fed hired in 2013 and 14, who are now paying more for their retirement without any additional benefits, those two increases still save the federal government over $20 billion. And that's just in a 10-year time frame. You look at that 20, 30, 40 years out, that's going to be a lot more in savings. But you're right, to hit the actives will save a lot more money than prospectively. You know, it's the goal of NARF and that of our fellow groups in the federal community that they find savings elsewhere. The federal community has given over $120 billion in savings over the last several years, which, you know, the biggest chunk of that being the three-year pay freeze. It's time these members of Congress looked elsewhere than the federal employee piggy bank.
Well, there's something that's not on the radar scope of a lot of federal workers or retirees, and it certainly should be. It's a little bit complicated, but I know it's the kind of thing that keeps you up at night, and it's the focus of one of your primary nightmares, the chained CPI. What is that?
So the chained CPI is a different way of calculating the annual COLAs that federal retirees receive in their annuities, as well as Social Security benefits, disability benefits, military pensions. This could affect, you know, everyone across the board, depending on how it's implemented. So it would be the current measure is the CPIW. The measure they're looking at using would be then the chained CPIU. And what the chained CPI does is it assumes that people are not as impacted by inflation as the current measure says they are, because they will make modifications to their behavior. Most common example being, when the price of beef rises, you buy more chicken, and therefore you are not as impacted by the increasing beef prices. What it doesn't account for, however, are the things that there are no substitute for, such as medication. And if you are over the age of 65, chances are you are spending more on healthcare costs than those under the age of 65. And that substitution effect doesn't work across the board. There is not always a substitute for medicine, for putting gas in your car, for your electrical provider. You know, you don't get to choose who provides electricity to your house, right? So it doesn't work for the senior population. And we don't believe that the chain CPI is, we don't believe the current measure is an accurate measure of how seniors spend their money. The chain CPI just exacerbates that.
Well, I always like the fact that they say people adjust their spending habits, and they do, as you point out, when they're controllable, when there is an option. So you can go from lobster to steak to hamburger to chicken. But at what happens after chicken? Is mm-hmm. cat food? Is that the end of the line? You have a figure.
Tuna in a can, perhaps.
Yeah,
is
right.
The next place, then maybe the cat food.
Well, you have a figure, and every time I ask you for it, and you tell me, I'm astounded at how high it is. But assuming the chain CPI went into effect, and that is, they're using a different method to calculate inflation, and it would produce a very small decrease in the cost of living adjustment, but it would be each year, and it would be compounded. What do you estimate over the lifetime of a typical retiree?
If you look at the typical CSRS retiree, over 25 years, a switch to the chain CPI will cost that retiree over $50,000 because, as you mentioned, that compounding effect. 0.3% is the usual difference, has been the average difference between the current measure and the chain CPI. So 0.3% 1 year, the next, probably not that big of a deal, you know, a few bucks here, a few bucks there, but it's that compounding over time that will lead it to be $50,000 for just your average CSRS retiree. If your listeners are curious as to what the chain CPI would mean for them, we have a calculator on the homepage of the NARF website. You can type in what your annual annuity is, how long you expect to receive that annuity, and you can get a chain CPI figure for yourself.
That's www.narf.org.
It is. Thank
okay.
you.
Take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM, and then we'll be right back.
And And now it's time for another FedGuard Factor, career essentials for federal employees.
You know professional liability protection is important in today's federal workplace. So ask yourself this question. Is it better to have it and not need it, or need it and not have it? When you consider legal fees can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, why risk it? The FedGuard protection is less than $300 a year, and it provides you with a knowledgeable attorney and covers the legal fees, too. Don't go it alone.
Learn more at FedGuard.com. That's FedGuard.com.
A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in every Monday at 10:05 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee. For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, has the answers to your career retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit, sponsored by WEPA, Mondays at 10:05 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. for topics and ideas that could change your future. For free information, visit NITPINC.com and WAEPA.org.
With an EasyPass Flex, all carpools with three or more occupants can travel toll-free on the new 95 express lanes. Plus, who couldn't use an extra $230? Through pool rewards, qualified commuters who currently drive alone and form or join a new carpool may receive up to $230 in cash when using the 95 express lanes. Qualified van pools receive $200 per month. Some restrictions apply. Visit commuterconnections.org.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up
at 5. For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
All of Federal News Radio's exclusive interviews and shows are archived online at federalnewsradio.com. Listen to an interview again or share it with friends. Find it at federalnewsradio.com.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Jessica Clement. She's legislative director for the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Before that, she'd worked with the Federal Managers Association, and before that, you were a staffer on Capitol Hill.
I was, and I don't like to think about that anymore. Okay. It was a little longer ago.
You're a little long in the tooth now to work on the Hill. That's a
little bit. The Hill is a very, very different place these days than when I was there. Actually, the member I worked for just retired last year, so it's the first year I've been in D.C. that he's not on the Hill anymore. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, Andy Medici and I were doing a little ancient history talk, but it's starting with Bill Clinton. You had the Federal Comparability Act, the Pay Act. It was voted in by a Democratic Congress. President George H.W. Bush signed it into law, so it was totally bipartisan. It was supposed to start a new era in pay raises, and we wouldn't have these annual fights and be no such thing as a freeze or whatnot. But President Clinton was the first one to implement it. Story is, he came in from Arkansas. His salary in Arkansas was less than the typical federal worker in the Washington area. They were horrified by the pay situation, and he recommended a 0% pay raise. And the Washington area delegations in those days, Republicans and Democrats, were both very pro-federal worker. You had Connie Morello, a Republican in Maryland, and Tom Davis and Frank Wolf and others, Republicans who were very pro-federal worker, Elijah Cummings, Steny Hoyer, Jim Moran in the Democrats, and they worked together to go around whoever was in office. If it was a Democrat in office, Steny Hoyer would take the lead and do an end run around the president. If it was a Republican, George Bush, he would do an end run around him, and they got better pay raises for federal workers that way, and invariably higher than the president's recommended. Is there a chance that the good days will ever come back, or is this like saying the buffalo are coming back to the West?
Well, I think in order to maintain some sort of sanity, I have to believe that these days will come back, right? Otherwise, I think you and I would have a tough time just getting through the day.
Yeah.
I think it's possible. I think both sequestration and furloughs that resulted from sequestration, as well as the government shutdown, shed a lot of light on what federal employees do in places where, even outside the Washington, D.C. metro area outside places like California and Texas and Washington State, where, you know, most people know there are a lot of federal employees, really shed some light on what federal employees do, you know, in the heartland, in the middle of America, where people don't often think federal employees live and work, despite the fact that 85% of them do live outside D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. So I think that helped. Certainly, I don't think anyone's really thrilled with a 1% pay raise this year and last year, but it's, you know, better than a pay freeze. I think we're going to start returning to regular pay raises, maybe not next year, but soon. We're certainly going to work to do that. I think the tide could definitely turn. Sometimes I think it's better if federal employees just stay off the radar altogether.
Yeah.
You know, to put a pay raise in an appropriations bill, which had been the standard up until, you know, we got to the pay freeze several years ago, would certainly draw attention to the fact that there would be a pay raise. So, you know, one might ask themselves, is it better to just let the president decide pay, even if that is only 1%, or if it would be better off returning to regular order in an appropriations bill? I think that remains to be seen. But I think, if nothing else, the government shutdown definitely helps shed some good light on what federal employees do for this country.
Well, it's interesting. Many people, they had this from beyond the Beltway, had this idea of Washington is a city of government clerks and green eye shades who all work in one building, and we interact daily with the president. In fact, as anybody who lives here knows, not that way at all. And there are several cities, several areas I can think of: Huntsville, Alabama; San Antonio, mm-hmm. Texas; Ogden,
yep.
Utah, where the government is a bigger factor than it is here. And I know in Ogden, Utah, if you don't work for the Interior Department, the Internal Revenue Service, or the Air Force, you probably don't work, you know, or maybe the VA. And this is true in so many cities. And Huntsville, Alabama is a miniature D.C. It's got the presence of virtually every federal agency here, and it's a much smaller community, but it's a much more important place. And I wonder, do people try to make that point with members of Congress? I mean, say,
oh, we certainly do. And I know my colleagues at the other federal employee organizations do as well. I mean, we have state-specific fact sheets for every state that our members take with them when they go to the Hill, that we take with us when we're up lobbying on the Hill. It's really important to embark on that education campaign. I was actually having a conversation with Max Steyer of the Partnership for Public Service the other week, and he was saying, you know, federal employees need to do a better job of being their own best advocates. They do some tremendous things for our country that they don't talk about, or too shy to talk about, or don't even realize maybe the impact that they're having. And I couldn't agree with that statement more. I think it's really important for federal employees and retirees to tell their story. What did you do for this country? Make it personal. I think that's how we're going to make inroads in this Congress.
Well, you're looking at what federal workers do. If you go to these the Senior Executive Association's banquet, I know you've been to a number of them, and you sit at a table with these people, and you look at the dollar savings they've made, or the contributions they've made in health and safety and anti-terrorism and whatnot, and it's absolutely mind-blowing. And I've always thought somebody could film that session or do a 15-minute program of that, the public would have a lot better feeling of what kind of bang they're getting for their tax buck.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. You know, not just the rank awards, but also the Service to America medals that are put on every year, really highlighting the best of the best. You know, I think it's 7-8 awards to federal employees. You sit there watching these videos, these tremendous things that they are doing, and that's just one night, and it gets, you know, press coverage in the trades. And
yeah, it's preaching to the choir. It really is,
but it doesn't seem to be of interest to people who are not already part of a choir, and that's really a shame.
Yeah. We're talking with Andy Medici from the Federal Times about the outgoing Postmaster General, Mr. Donahoe, and at the press club, he made a pitch for the Postal Service having a standalone retirement system, which would eliminate the defined benefit and depend on employee contributions to a 401k and Social Security. And he suggested that the Postal Service try it out, and then maybe it could spread to the rest of government. How likely is that?
Well, I think he certainly tried in his time as Postmaster General. Much to the dismay both of NARF and the postal groups, this is a horrible idea. You're taking away one-third of postal employees, you know, retirement benefits. It's the three-legged stool, and you're cutting off one of the legs.
And it's the only guaranteed one too, right?
It is the only guaranteed one. Although I'm sure there's some Social Security advocates out there that may disagree with that statement. You know, you have Social Security, the TSP, and FERS, and FERS is a defined benefit system. And you know, people use the excuse, members of Congress, Postmaster General alike, well, the private sector is moving away from that, and states are moving away
Lauren,
from that.
Our producer, Lauren Larson, is giving me the hook here. Signed. Thank you very much for being with us.
No,
you're real
for
busy.
Me.
We'll get you back. Thanks very much. Have a good week. We'll see you here next Wednesday at 10 a.m.